It's my great pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Dominic Shaner. He is a musician extraordinaire, musicologist, adding information of enormous interest to me and others to these events. When he suggested a four-part series spread over 4 months, 1 month, I was excited to have that happen. So please join me in welcoming Dominic Shaner back to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you. If you've been to one of my concerts before, it's going to be a little different, maybe a little more talking. I do have little programs here that just, I don't know if you've got one, but it has a little biography. That I wrote up of Francesco, and then also some quotes from contemporaries about him. And tonight's talk and playing will try to illustrate who Francesco was and maybe why he was important and why he's been forgotten. The title is called, well, two things. I always have two titles. I can't decide which one is better. They both mean different things. One is Il Divino, because this is a title that Francesco received during his lifetime, and it means the divine in Italian. He was an Italian composer, worked in the papal courts his entire life, so was the sole lutenist to the Pope, that the Pope would take on diplomatic missions, would play for his bedtime, all sorts of things. Francesco was the prized lutenist, and he had kind of the prized position of the time. And the only other individual in history to be given the title Il Divino is Michelangelo. And today, we all know who Michelangelo is. We could probably name a few of his pieces offhand, even recall them, what they look like in our minds. But if you hear Francesco da Milano, you may not know who he is, or even recall some of his pieces. So the repertoire I chose tonight all explores a motive that I think he was really fond of, because many of his pieces are based off this arrangement of notes. And so we'll kind of explore Francesco in a very kind of specialized way. So the music you'll hear tonight is only a sliver of what he wrote. And of that, it's very specific, and it all relates to each other. So you kind of get the world of his sound in your ear. But the other title is Oral Images of Lost Traditions, and that refers to how lute music was written and published. Lute music was not published. You may be familiar with music on a staff or a system where you have pitches, and the higher they go, the higher the sound that you hear, and the lower they go, the lower the sound. The lute was written in a form of tablature, which tells you where to put your fingers on the frets and which strings to pluck. And why this is important is twofold. One, electric guitarists didn't invent tablature. And the second one is it tells you clearly what note was meant to be played. So for example, if you have something descending, you can have a cadence like that. I forgot what cadence I played. Or you can have a cadence where you descend and go lower. You may hear this, the leading tone. So you have two different ways of playing that note. One raised, and you have that, which is very familiar, or the one where it's lowered. In Renaissance music of the time, that often wasn't notated in the music. You would have just the notes, you wouldn't have sharps or flats. So what Luke Tablature tells us is exactly the stylistic concerns that the players were interested in. What if they liked, you know, notes sharp and kind of chromatic, or if they liked things in minor keys, major keys. And that's what we'll explore tonight. Because through Francesco's tablature, we have a clear idea of what the taste of the time was. And interestingly, what the taste of the time and what the taste that was popular for many years after Francesco had died. So I'll open this up with a short piece that was published during his lifetime in 1536, and then I'll play it. It was again published in 1580, so almost 40 years after he had died. He died in 1543. Does a few different things. You may hear this that imitation. You may also hear a semitone cadence. But then you also hear it earlier. So he has those two notes that he changes, goes back and forth. There's not one that's standard. So a lot of times when we look back to this music, we think, okay, well, they must have all done it. There is some sort of standard, and what's that standard that we're looking for? And I find a lot of times we impose things that from our knowledge of music today that really, we have printed books, we have music, we have descriptions, but we don't have the sound that they're after. And to really understand what the sound is, you'd have to look at a piece like this and dissect the little pieces. Because one cadence in the middle of the piece, we have that, which is very strong to us today. At the end of the piece, we have this cadence. So we have this descending motive. But then what it does is it's the final cadence of the piece. The third thing are his interest in half steps. So all of this material is either whether you have a semitone, so a small half step, or a full tone. And listen for it this time with the imitation, and then also the semitones. That. And see if you can hear his cadences. That in the middle, and then the end. If the end sounds unexpected, or if it sounds just kind of a calming, relaxed ending to a piece. Thank you.
cadence. I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
What does that mean? Is it the sequence of notes? Is it the
So feel free to ask questions or clarify things. We'll get a feeling for where we're all at, and let's see. So a cadence is like a period or a comma in a in written language. So a pause or the ending of an idea. You need to think about this music not in terms of chords to a melody, but multiple melodies kind of weaving in and out, and some may, when one ends, another may begin. So that first part, that's the cadence there. It resolves on that high note, and then immediately the bass. You can think of it as four part singer. So we have a soprano, and then the bass comes in. And if you hear, the soprano stays on that note. So that's the line. So we have two little, we have one thought, and then a comma, and then we have another thought. Half step. And a little cadence. Francesco, when he was writing, the way he understood music was not was not through the lute. So it would be, if he was listening to Palestrina or Josquin, these vocal composers that would write, four singers or five, six, seven, up to eight singers, independent lines weaving in and out. So that's where he's coming from. It's not, at the end you have a cadence where it may be fuller, where you have a chord resolving to another chord. But here you have independent lines beginning and ending.
Did he write just for the lute?
He only wrote for the lute. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a lute player. And he was hired by, he died fairly young, so 1497 to 1543. And he was employed, I think by the time he was 16, he was already a full-time paid musician in the papal court. Let's see, there was one other thing about this piece I wanted to mention. So, with that in mind, we have kind of a skeleton of his music. I'll play a little intro of another piece published by two other lute players, and you can tell me if it's Francesco or they put their name on it, but here it is. So we have Francesco's piece published in 1536. And then a piece published in 1546 under the name Giovanni Maria da Crema. So it takes Francesco's piece, and he adds some embellishments, some faster notes where we had longer notes in Francesco's piece. And that's bringing the other point I wanted to make was in this one we have this melody, and we have this note that's been re-articulated on the lute. But I would say we have, when your question about the cadence, the beginning of the line is on that note, and the ending is also on that note. The reason it's the lute player restrikes it is because Francesco marks it, but then also, if you're a singer, you can sustain a note for as long as you can hold your breath. So as long as you, as deep as you can breathe, you can sustain the note, whereas the lute, the notes die out. So have these figures that are merely there. They're not there for musical, like a structural aspect, you know, denoting cadences or where the line begins and ends, but just to sustain the sonority. So there we have the. One other thing, which we'll hear in other pieces, but I'll play that this little section again. You can hear these little figures of half step. Them, and this is something that Francesco explores throughout his life. There is a few fantasias. One is very famous. So it has that half step motif. There's another one that is somewhat overlooked, but it is built around that same structure. And this piece is, all these pieces are titled Fantasias or Ricercare. Ricercare means to seek out. It's from the Italian word, and fantasy is just a, you know, fantasy on an idea. So you can think of it as, you know, the seeking out of a melody or of a little tune. You know, maybe Francesco starts with that. He likes that little figure. And then he figures out different ways to play it. Here, we have the seeking out of this. So, that little figure has four notes. One, two, three, four, which played. That is not a scale in Western music, so that's not part of the major scale or the minor scale, because we have half step, full step, half step, both of these ends kind of pulling in at each other. We go hot, up, and we want to fall, going down, wanting to rise again. So there already I mentioned why tablature is so important, so that's one example. That we have the beginning of this piece is comprised of notes that wouldn't, you wouldn't look back and say, okay, well, he's writing in this key, or he's using this scale, because those notes don't fit in any of those.
So I understand, you're saying that the tablature notation gives you an absolute reference of the notes that are mm-hmm. played, but it doesn't fall into a particular scale.
Exactly. So if we were, if you saw something written on like a piano clef, we would be in the key, you know, say we're in the key of C, or let's say we're in the key of F, which has a B flat. That flat goes down there. That would be a chromatic note. So in the original notation, they would not write in all the sharps. And that was just for, just to save money. So music was printed on the printing press. It would be easy to make notations at the beginning on your clef. You write your sharps or your flats and then just print all the music. But then to go through and mark every little, you know, chromatic, or, you know, it's called ficta, every little change where you're, okay, no, that note you sing, you know, you sing lower. So you don't sing this note, you sing this note. This note, we sing that higher note. That was just something that the musicians understood the style that they were singing, so they didn't need to write in all those little extra notes. Whereas on Francesco's, it's there. You can't, if he wrote a tablature. the system tells you exactly where to put your fingers. So there's no way of, oh, he didn't mean that note, he meant this note. I can't change it.
I see.
So the tablature tells us exactly the specific note for every single note. Whereas in vocal music of the time, there was a lot of parts up for discussion, usually around cadences. Do you have a cadence that ends like that, or because those two notes would be, you know, those could be both G's. You have a G natural or a G sharp.
And they're not the notation.
The notation wouldn't add that extra sharp.
It was just understood at the time.
Are you gonna let us look at the notation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I can pass that around while I'm speaking.
And so, for you as a lute player, this would be a much better system for you.
Well, the reason it was used for lute players is because there are lutes in all different sizes. So if Francesco wanted to write a piece, you know, he just wrote the tablature, and then every lute player played it. But this is a lute in G. There's one that's a little longer, that's an F. A little shorter, that's an A. So if you wrote the note's name, so, you know, G, B flat, A, then you would have to rewrite it for every single, you know, different lute. The early pages have examples of tablature. And then further along you have modern edition. So I'll play a little bit of this.
What do the numbers mean?
So that
is that a finger?
The numbers are the zeros open, 1, 2, 3, they tell you which frets. And we'll go into there's a system that uses numbers, a system that uses letters, and systems that invented their own symbols, because you had to have a symbol for every string and fret intersection. But really, the reason I also chose these pieces is because you have, printing was relatively new by the time Francesco was around, and to print music, it took a lot of money. You needed an audience for it. Francesco was lucky; he wasn't wealthy, but he worked for probably the wealthiest, you know, court in Europe. And a lot of people wanted to please the Pope or things like that, so they would offer to publish Francesco's music. His first books were published in 1536, and then he died in 1543. So that wasn't a lot of time while he was alive to publish the music. Most of his music was then published from the 1540s to 1580s. So that tells us a few different things. That tells us that not only were things that were written about him during his life, were they possibly true, or they were actually kind of serious accounts. Sometimes you have these parodies of someone, you know, just writing something about someone that either doesn't exist, or it's not really that true, or it can't be, it's not seen in other sources. But Francesco is considered the greatest lutenist of his time by his contemporaries and by those lutenists that came after him. So books published in 1552 and 1555, they changed his name to Il Divino Francesco da Milano. And this is after, usually most accounts of him being called Il Divino were during his time in Rome at the papal court. So we have that. The other thing is, you have to understand that the lute was changing. So musical styles were changing. By 1600, we lose this sort of counterpoint where we have multiple voices weaving in and out. We no longer have four singers singing independent lines, all weaving around each other. We have opera, which is essentially chord to a melody. And so if you understand that change and how dramatic that was, that would be like if, you know, everyone stopped singing pop songs and, you know, did sound recordings and drone or something like that. You know, it's like, it's pretty severe that instead of having the lute player weave these intricate melodies and counterpoint, they would just play chords to a singer or another a solo instrument. And despite all these changes in the style of music and also with the instrument, so this is a six-course lute, but by 1600, this would be 8 or 9 courses. We would have had low strings added. The neck would have been extended, and that would have been the basic lute. Then we would have had an arch lute, which has a really long neck to play really low bass notes to offer a low register to singers. And then we would have a theorbo and all these other instruments. So despite all these changes, Francesco's music is still being published and is still being found written down in manuscripts. So a manuscript is someone taking the time and handwriting out his music. And this piece is a perfect example of this. It was published in 1547, which is actually the... So it was actually published during his life, but we have lost that book. There was a book published in 1542 that was lost, and then that book was republished, although some people believe that it had the same publisher, but they believe that it may or may not have been the same book. And that was this publication from 1547. Then again, I have my list here, it's hard to remember. This piece was published, again, in 52, 62, 66, 86, occurs in 2 Italian manuscripts at the end of the century, occurs in an English manuscript from 1620, so that's maybe 20, 25, 30 years into a new style of music has already kind of taken over Europe. And that's all that we have that survives. You can imagine manuscripts not surviving.
Because everyone's looking at this book. As I pass it on, so the numbers are which fret you're playing?
Which fret I am playing, and I think it's written on lines or spaces. Those are the strings.
Right.
Yeah.
On lines. And then you just play the same rhythm until you see another rhythmic
exactly.
Equation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that kind of speaks to the idea about musica ficta, whether writing in sharps or flats. You just wanted to conserve your resources. If you're printing this out, you don't want to have to change all the, you know, write the same rhythm over every single note, and then have when it changes, pull all that out and make a new slot to print. So very economic. And here we have a Fantasia, it's number 30 if you want to follow along in the music in that book. And this is that one that I'll play the earliest publication of it, and then the one that survives in the English manuscript from 1620. The piece sort of generates from. And here's the one from 1620 in England. And listen for the ornaments, the added notes. Thank you. We don't know who copied the manuscript, but that one, I would say Francesco wrote it, and then someone came across and ornamented it. And this is important because the idea of classical, of taking a composer's, you know, a piece of music that they wrote and then changing it or adding notes to it, is kind of unthinkable in the classical music tradition, but in the Renaissance and even in the Baroque, that was common practice. That was just part of performing, part of being a lute player. These pieces that Francesco published, they probably weren't how he played. They may have been, you know, like his roadmap, so to speak, and he would add ornaments himself. An interesting thing here, I don't want to get too technical, but in Francesco's piece, we have this. So that's kind of minor, where we have the cadence. And then in the English one from 1620, we have this. So that's a perfect example of something that is kind of fluid. You can play those notes raised, or you can play them lowered. Or really, they don't change the you know, the structure of the piece. And you may not even hear it, or you have something like this. Just kind of changes the energy. One that's really pushing forward momentum, I think, and the other that's just kind of being present and kind of relaxed. Not to get too technical, but this is another thing that kind of talks to, sort of answers your question, or just maybe asks more questions about it, but we have this line. So we have these four notes, all within that within two measures, which is part of, you know, is like a serial thing where you have a chromatic scale, but you wouldn't think of Renaissance music using the chromatic scale in that way. And the reason they get away with it because it's thought of the direction of the line. It's just kind of natural. The line's moving up, and then now it's coming down. And so you're not going to force notes to descend that want to ascend, or vice versa. So we have coming up, now down. So we don't really hear it, but if you look at all the notes that he's using and then try to figure out, okay, what scale is he using, what chords go to this, you cannot get any answers. And especially if we look at it from a 20th century, 21st century mindset, where we think of melodies happening in a key, melodies happening that are associated with certain chords, then we're just going to generate ideas that have nothing to do with the music. We're going to say, okay, well, maybe those notes are mistakes, maybe the printer you know, didn't put the correct figures in, and so now we have to change it. So a lot of this music, not only Francesco, but a lot of early lute music was edited for guitar in the earliest, in the 20th century, so Segovia and Bream played it, and that was what happened. Most of those editions are false now because they have notes changed to fit sort of the style of the 20th century, rather than taking the printed books for their word and saying, okay, that's actually what it was. You have a very famous vocal composer, Jess Waldo, who was composing at the end of the 16th century, around 1580, who wrote very chromatic things. And you in music school, you study about them because no other composer was writing those chromatic notes and these kind of melodies, but when you listen to it, it doesn't sound. You get this idea of, okay, well, chromatic is it like, you know, atonal Schoenberg stuff? Well, no, it's a little out there in terms of Renaissance music, but you have this, the idea of the line, the importance is of a single melody finding its direction while being accompanied by other melodies, and so you don't hear this kind of harsh interaction because we don't have this up and down. Music is not a moment that happens in time and we take a picture of it and we analyze it. It's this kind of fluid thing that's always happening, kind of a thread, if you follow a thread from through a loom, you have one little thread that goes all the way through, and you have, you know, colors that arise in certain spots and patterns that arise here, but really that's an individual thread and it goes all the way from the beginning to the end.
So are you saying that the music is more horizontal rather than vertical?
Exactly.
Harmonies,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And chords and
mm-hmm.
all that, but it's more, it's just in leading these melodies across.
Yeah. And you do have vertical things just as a result of that.
Result.
Uh-huh. And in the earliest 20th century, they would say, oh, you can't have that chord because you have this. Which no one in the Renaissance wrote that chord, but well, you have this note going down and then this note going up. So.
Yeah. So I was thinking the same observation that the flow of music is horizontal
mm-hmm.
rather than blocks of chords flowing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a different way of looking at it. What I was thinking of is sometimes when I listen to children singing in the playground, they'll do something like that. They're not particularly concerned
mm-hmm.
with the fact that they've hit a sour chord because the energy that they're manifesting is carrying the song forward.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a good analogy or not. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I think to talk about that a little bit, what's one of the more fascinating things of looking at this music is we have this example of Francesco's, the pieces that he published during his time, and then even up to 1620, we have notes changed, and we can already say, okay, well, the way it was heard or the way it was experienced was different then. So you kind of can start identifying, you know, what it would be like, what the ear, you know, what was in the sound of the time. You know, one, we have this, are they're very subtle, but it does offer some insight into what was the taste of the time, and to carry on, we have another one that explores this half step, and the reason I'm we're really focusing on this little motive of Francesco, so a little piece that then he builds larger pieces out of. Is because of his title Il Divino, and also many contemporaries equated him to Orpheus and Apollo, so he had this kind of godlike reputation where if he was playing, then he would just, you know, he'd just play anything. Like the quote about the dinner party, where he's just kind of plucking out a few notes and then just creates something from that. You can even hear that may just be a variation of this. So we have that half step, and maybe one day he's playing it like that. And so that ability of Francesco to have a piece that is really comprised of a very small building blocks, you know, a little motive like this, consisting of two notes, you know, one that's doubled, and then being able to kind of unravel a whole piece from that, it was sort of his artistry, I believe. And this one, I'll play a few selections. This is number 33 in the book, and number 34. And this was, like the previous piece, this was published throughout his lifetime, throughout the 16th century, and is also found in what is now called the Marsh Lute Book, 1620s manuscript in England. To maybe you hear these. It's like a puzzle trying to find all those little those half steps. And you may hear some that start out like in that mode, and then we sort of change kind of flavor of them. We have these minorish. And, you know, majorish sounding ones. Carry this on into the next one, is that within Francesco's music, I don't know if I wrote it in the description, but I wanted to talk about how his legacy continues, knowingly or unknowingly. There's, you know, if I were to say that that these pieces influenced Bach in his fugues or in his partitas, there's no proof that Francesco's music was published in Germany and may have been around where Bach was, but there's no evidence of Bach knowing the music of Francesco. But you hear things like this in Bach's music, where you have like a little exposition of an idea, and this is a perfect example. We go through this little half step that starts really high on the instrument and then goes all the way down to the lowest note. After that, then we have some scales that sort of ornament that idea. And then we have, after those scales sort of just kind of seamlessly take us to this. Again. So new imitative material that just sort of started to happen. It doesn't relate to this half step motive that we started the piece with. And this sort of writing where you have very strict counterpoint and kind of almost fugal writing, where you have one melody come in like row, row, row your boat around. You have one melody come in and then another comes in and the same thing, and it's the repetition of it is constant and almost overwhelming to try to hear all the entrances. And then we're sort of, the palate is cleansed, we're refreshed by these scales that are easy to follow, but then also reiterate that half-step motive, and then they just turn into something completely different, almost a change in affect. And this sort of writing in a solo piece for an instrument, you can see in the music of Bach. You know, his he has a very famous chaconne in D minor for solo violin that numerous other instruments play. Starts out with chords and a small little moving figure, and then it turns into some scales that rise, and then it ends in a kind of a flurry of notes. And I'll play a little thing of Francesco that I think is related to some of it, where we have chords. Within Francesco's music, and I'll continue to talk about this in the talks to come, that even though we don't have direct evidence of Bach studying his music, we do have this sort of kind of momentum, I guess, is the best word for lack of any other. But this idea of the structure, or these sort of just kind of patterns in music, these phrases that we have, a little exposition, that we have some chords that set, so, you know, give us time to set our ear in the world that the piece is going to happen, and then we have little imitative melodic lines that start, and then we don't have the fugal aspect until, you know, in the middle of the piece or much later. And in the Baroque we have suites. So in the Renaissance, we didn't have that. And so you can say, well, okay, well, Bach wrote a fugue. Well, yeah, but you know, he wrote a prelude to for the player to play before the fugue starts. And I believe that that sort of idea was already being investigated or already being composed during the Renaissance. It just wasn't called prelude and fugue. It was a fantasia or a Richard. The prelude just being those chords in the beginning, then we have the fugue later as in this piece.
I play harpsichord, mm-hmm. So this is really interesting to me, and I have played a little bit of transcribed, especially Dowland. What I'm thinking about is the thread of to get to Bach is maybe perhaps through Frescobaldi and Froberger,
mm-hmm.
who wrote for the keyboard,
yeah.
And that maybe they heard this music,
yeah,
or something like it, and then that sort of moved on to,
mm-hmm.
to Bach and the others.
Yeah, Bach did play, there is a Bach was friends with a lute player, Silvius Leopold Weiss, but the lute that Weiss was playing looked nothing like this. It was tuned to an open chord, so which means instead of, you know, this sound, it's not like that. So you'd strum all the open strings of the baroque lute, and you would have a nice sonority like that instead of strings tuned in intervals that have nothing to do with harmony. There is one other piece I'd like to play that sort of, I think, is a nice example of a fugue. Maybe one of the earliest ones. This was published in 1536, I believe. And this is actually one that was, there was a German lute player, Sixt Cargill, I'm probably pronouncing his last name correctly, but he republished three of Francesco's pieces in the 80s, 1580s. And this is one of them. This is number 66 in the book. Here it is. I mean, 1574 is when the Sixt Cargill republished it. And I won't play the beginning, but it sort of starts out. I'll play a little bit of the beginning. We already have the fascination of the Francesco with the half step right there. This is the melody that will be repeated. Research and see exactly how many other instrumental pieces have that sort of imitation as early as 1536. And then to end, and we get some time for questions, I have this piece by Francesco, another one that was published during his lifetime, and then again, I think this one, I got over here. This is from a manuscript in 1600. And I'll try to play it so you can hear these. I think it's written in three distinct parts. And he has one imitative idea that he explores. Excuse me. So a thought that he seeks out. And then he kind of resolves that, does what he can with it, and then starts something else. And then sees that through, and then begins something else. And so you almost have a suite in this piece, or you have three distinct ideas that are explored in one fantasia. Does it? If you have any questions, feel free to ask. Yeah.
How long did his music continue to be printed? You know, like that.
Printed until I think the 1580s. Yeah.
And then.
So then you find it in manuscripts after that. So there is.
You do. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yes. So and that's important because. Because around 1580, you have the Florentine Camerata, and this was a gathering of musicians, of poets, of, you know, just kind of scholars, and this is where the idea of opera first kind of germinated, and that was about 1580, and you have Galileo, his father. Part of that, and that's an important, especially with the printing of books, because at that time in Italy someone wouldn't print Francesco's music, because we had this sort of trend essentially instigated by the powerful people of the time, you know, the towards this looking back in ancient Greece and how dramas were thought to be performed, where you have a chord and then you have someone telling a story, a single line telling the story and the singer and the instruments are just to kind of support that singular thought or that one melody. Another reason for this is because if you can imagine five different people singing the same words but kind of starting at different times, and can you really understand what's going on? So that was around the same time, and then that coincided with the lack of printing of Francesco. What's also interesting, you ask a question it could string on forever, is that I didn't mention it here or tonight, but Vincenzo Galilei, so this is Galileo's father, was a very famous musical theorist, and he was part of the Florentine Camerata, which eventually sort of invented opera or kind of started that trend. He published in the 60s, 1560, he published in 1563 a book wherein he gifts the world six new pieces by Francesco, which was a lie. Vincenzo Galilei took little parts of Francesco's piece and kind of made a collage, and then said, oh, here in this book are six new pieces by Francesco. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most important instances just to really say, hey, this is who Francesco was, this is how important he was. So not only you have Galilei who knows the kind of political power of the time and what influence is, if he publishes a book that he dedicates to his patron and then gives his patron six new pieces by the most famous lutenist of the century that no one else has except for in this book. And then not only it's this individual that published the old music is one of the people that is to bring in the new opera. And so you have Francesco existing in both worlds, and you don't have, not that I know of any other composer doing that. What also speaks to this is Francesco being likened to Orpheus and Apollo. The first operas were about Orpheus. And so you just consider it's not like all of a sudden everyone's interested in Orpheus and that story. Well, no, that probably was something that kind of gained steam and was kind of in the zeitgeist for a while. And to really understand what that means for someone to say, hey, this player is akin to Orpheus or Apollo, even superior, some people consider him.
So I'm curious what your understanding is of why he disappeared from collective memory, whereas someone like Michelangelo.
I just think it's the nature of music. We don't have any recordings of it. What I try to do tonight is look at some of this music, and you can see how we have sort of recordings by it existing in the tablature, but then the lute died out. So it's a few different and kind of a lot of things. Like Michelangelo, his art was there. And, you know, there's people I've studied with that think, or that encouraged me to go along with musicology and spend my life in the, underneath the Vatican, because they believe that there's probably some manuscripts by Francesco there,
mm-hmm.
Considering he was there for 30 plus years. And and I think it's also the idea that's sort of lost to us today is that the always like ever creating, always taking this piece and then reworking it, recreating it. So it wasn't like we had a Francesco piece and that was preserved and everyone that played it, if I gave it to you, you'd play it, you wouldn't change any notes, it would always be the same. We don't have that. So in the pieces that I played, every little piece, even though it was republished, there'd be slight variations. So as someone taking this piece by Francesco and then sort of, adding their own voice to it or adding whatever was popular in their town at their time. And so you don't have a singular thing that you could put Francesco's stamp on and say, okay, this is perfectly how he did it and it's unchanged ever since. So he is sort of has that kind of myth characteristic to his legacy.
That's an interesting idea. How about music then got so solidified?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it's written, that's the way you're supposed to play it. And
yeah.
It wasn't like that back then.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah.
So did that, you said that the lute was no longer played, essentially,
for
a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And is it the early music in the late 20th century, is that the early music thing that brought the lute back and this music?
Was it Mendelssohn that brought back, like even Bach was sort of
mm-hmm.
out of fashion for a while.
That's right.
Or not out of fashion, just not considered great. How he's considered a great composer today. You have Bream that played the guitarist, bring it back, but you have, there's a famous harpsichordist, Linda, or Wondowski, or someone,
Wanda
I believe.
Wondowski.
Yeah, yeah. The problem with the lute is that the lute, being the most popular instrument of the time, would change alongside the musical styles. So when the music changed, the lute was still very popular. Well, let's just make a new lute. Let's have I still want this sort of thing to play with the new style. So you have a whole family of instruments that then if someone was born in the 1600s and wanted to play the music of Francesco, well, it'd be very difficult for them to do that, even though there are manuscripts being written of the music. The instruments weren't necessarily the ones that Francesco played, and you can just say, okay, I'm going to play that music on this lute, because the lutes were being made for the current musical styles.
Were lutes ever played in groups or consorts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's publications for lutes alone, sort of like duets and trios. There's actually an interesting, I didn't mention it tonight, but in around 1560s, there was a lute player that published half a dozen or maybe 10 pieces of Francesco's and wrote lute duet parts to them. And that's the only example of a lute duet where you have a piece that exists as a solo piece and then a duet piece added. Most of the lute duets and trios and quartets are taking pieces from other instruments and rewriting them for that ensemble. Like if you have eight voices singing a piece, well, you can't fit all that on one lute, so you divide it up. These unique examples that are specific to Francesco and don't exist anywhere else.
I keep asking questions, but
yeah.
There's another one. The relationship of the oud to the
yeah.
Lute.
So that you can see that here. This is the not the earliest lute. So the lute did come from the oud during the Crusades and the silk trading route, and it was in Europe for a long time before you see it in iconography. It was in Europe a long time before music was published for it. There's actually an early manuscript that has like tuning diagrams for a lute, but no music, and it's part of a vocal manuscript from the I think it's the late 13th century. But you could see the oud was played with a plectrum, so a pick, and was mostly played on the top string, the lower strings offering kind of bass notes or just kind of drone, hit that and do something up here. And that is mirrored on the lute, where we have the top string is singled. So lutes are strung in courses, but there's always an odd number. And the reason for that is the top string is always single. And that is a characteristic that comes directly from the oud. Because initially, lute players would play with a pick, they'd hold between these two fingers and alternate like this. The pick was dropped, and then the technique is to alternate the fingers like this. So it's that same sort of motion, but without the pick. And the reason it was dropped was an example of the lute changing to the current musical styles. They wanted to play polyphony. They wanted to play more than one note at a time. And not only that, but kind of weave these little melodies that we're talking about together. And you couldn't do that with a pick. Also, the bowed back, the bent back headstock, And this, you know, the oud kind of comes out like this. This was also for reasons of just kind of economic, spatial reasons. You have books that are published that show, you know, maybe a gamba player sitting here, where you have music facing in four different directions for people sitting around a table to sit and play. And you don't want, you know, this adds 6 to 8 inches. You don't want, you know, swing and hit someone. And the frets are tied on, so the tape's not historical. So you can move your.
Were they moved for different tunings?
Sort of, but not usually. They were what Vincenzo Galilei talks about is that equal temperament, which we're getting in deep, was first explored on the lute. So Bach, equal temperament is the same space between every is a uniform semitone, so that the semitone is, instead of, I could have like a kind of, so I hear that. You hear the difference is ever so slight. It's like if you cut all the black keys on the piano in half, you have a major semitone and a minor semitone. So let's see. I have a major third and I have a minor third. What equal temperament is getting rid of a major semitone, so the space between this fret and a minor semitone. Whereas now I just have one semitone, I have one half step. Frets allow me to have kind of pure intervals that exist in nature in the overtone series. So it wasn't like the lute player would readjust all their frets, but most of the music was published in certain modes where you can make arguments where frets would be set a certain way. Because equal temperament allows you to play in all the keys. So, you know, if you wanted to play in C sharp, you could do it. If you wanted to play in G flat, you could. But the lute, you're just playing the key that the lute is tuned to, and the music fits on it. You don't need to play in all these different keys. So you would be able to tune your instrument perfectly in that sort of mode.
So it wouldn't be equal temperament.
It would be different. Meaning
pure,
different,
like a Pythagorean mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not perfectly pure, but. You know, in equal temperament, you have pure fifths and pure octaves, and then everything else is tempered.
Was there at the time any sort of aesthetic argument about whether one was superior to the other?
Well, at the time, in the Renaissance, there wasn't an idea of equal temperament.
Okay.
Aesthetics are, you wouldn't, a vibrato was used as an ornament. It was, if you sang with vibrato, that's a poor voice. And you can think of it, if you're singing this note and like, okay, well, I'm singing that note and like two others and maybe a third, but you know, you have this kind of what is called straight tone or pure tone now. But yeah, so the oud does not have frets, but you can get all those notes without having to change your frets, and that sort of explains the difference between like why does, you know, Arabic music sound different than Western music. Why do these different, you know, musics from different areas sound different? Well, one explanation is the tuning system that they use. So the basic fundamentals that they're using are a little different. Now these are ribs. This is U, Y-E-W. It looks cool, but this is actually the scraps from the nice U. So this is my very first lute, the student lute. The nice U would be all this color. Wouldn't have these knots in it, which please the eye, but now it's very difficult to find lutes made in U because I believe it has it's used for medicine, for combating certain types of cancer. It was also used for bow making, so if you could imagine the sort of bend you have to get to shape it.
What's your soundboard made out of?
This is a spruce. So yeah, there's a lot of spruce in Europe. My nice lutes are used. They want sun. What is it? So during the winter months, they want the sun exposure. Then it does something to the grain. It kind of creates this ripple effect.
I want to invite you, before we end, I want to invite you to just mention that you've got these CDs.
Oh, yeah.
Here.
So that's something
so what
completely
what
different.
Are these?
One,
this is what we've had in the past.
Yeah. The one is, all of it is original. One is some pieces that I wrote for Baroque lute that then arranged for guitar.
And that's which piece?
That's that one you've had in the past.
Right.
And then
this one here.
Yeah, that's that one. And then this one with the score is a piece for voice, seven viols, and organ, written in a Tintinnabuli style, which Arvo Pärt developed, where you have the notes of a triad kind of arpeggiated, and that is juxtaposed with notes moving in stepwise motion. And that's something we'll kind of explore in these talks, is the idea of 20th century minimalists taking their ideas from Renaissance and medieval composers. And you find that sort of compositional process in some of these lute pieces. And then the last one is recordings from my radio show. So it's me doing sound collage with electric guitar, and then there's some Fiorbo pieces by myself and Robert de Vizé and Castaldi. But so if you like Fiorbo music, it's on there, but there's only one track I think where it's solo Fiorbo. Others, it's me kind of weaving in sound collage stuff while I'm playing. Mm. All right, so.
Are you around here?
Yeah, I live out by Occidental. So, yeah, can't be here.
Are you teaching something?
I do teach. I teach music and do a radio show with at-risk youth. So I teach at TLC Child and Family Services.
And the radio station is on Cows.
Yeah,
we
radio station
have
on
our
Cows.
Have our Mystical Positivist radio show as well.
Yeah.
Does anybody know when the... did they get their antenna approved, or is it still
regrettably not. That's that got torpedoed.
It did.
By people with lots of money.
We did change the frequency to 92.5, so that it's
okay.
A little better receptivity in the area.
Okay, so the other antenna is broadcasting a little broader now.
It
I think
it's just
a little clearer.
Yeah, it's clearer because there's a Livermore Christian rock station that moved its antenna so that it was no longer shadowed by, I think, Mount Diablo, and that was just completely washed out our low power signal.
Gotcha.
At 107.3, so we got approval to move to 92.5, which is a relatively open area. There's certain areas in the county you'll get some Bay Area interference, but more in the county you can hear it more consistently. The Sevastopol is a little problematic because there's a hill shadow that, which is why we were trying to move the antenna in the first place. But
right.
We were not able to move to the location that we had designated, partly because of neighbors not being supportive of the project.
So anyway, I just want to thank Dominic for this wonderful discussion and demonstration. Thank you all for coming tonight. But let's give a round of applause. And I encourage you to contribute to the donation bowl over here, and also consider buying a couple of these guys, as I've just done myself.
Do you always have the CDs here?
We haven't, but we could, I guess, assuming that.
Yeah, it could be
Dominic's agreeable.
You could also, I guess, sample some of the things.